Okay. Yeah.
And I suspect, you know, someone's watching from the camera in the back. No, it's not pointing this way. So it is the 5th of March. And so we're talking about ownership of content created online. Now, I will throw the question back to you. Is that work unprotected by copyright upon creation?
Not upon creation, because copyright automatically goes to any owner.
That's correct. So what is it that they are then doing?
They're waiving their rights to it.
They're releasing it into the public domain, which is their choice. But it doesn't eliminate the initial... They cannot invalidate the operation of law. At that moment, they hold copyright. And they have to. Because if they don't hold copyright, they can say whatever they want, but they cannot affect the status of that. The other alternative is people who come across a file online. Actually, well, I'll get to that. I've now read it online. It shouldn't be owned by anyone. Information wants to be free. You have every right to say that, but it's a free speech right. It's not a legally enforceable copyright-changing right. So people like that, will it catch on? I don't know what that means. People who create intellectual property and release all of it into the public domain are either workers of governments whose works are by statute automatically released into the public domain, or people who have other means of financial support. When Louis C.K. shot his comedy special and posted it online, pay if you want, it got a lot of, I think, deserved attention for being a pioneer. That wasn't his first comedy special. That was, okay, I've already made my money. Now let's experiment with this, but I don't have to worry about eating. Licensing is about money. Now, you may license for no money, but the idea of a license comes back to the idea of ownership. Without ownership, there's no ability to license. And ownership of intellectual assets derives from the idea that people should be able to support themselves based on their creativity. You were going to say?
And how did Louis C.K. end up doing?
He did all right, but he has a fan base. If I decided to release my first comedy special, well, no one would pay for it either, so I'd have to do it for free, but I wouldn't get a whole lot of donations. You know, you have to have made it in order to have the ability not to charge. So, yes, there are people who are ideologically opposed to the notion of copyright, and that's fine for them. They can either start their own country. There is a former oil drilling platform off, I think it's in the North Sea, which is outside of any national, it's in international waters. And it has been declared its own little mini country where there are no intellectual property laws, but that's not really playing well with others. But if you're not on that little platform, the most one can do in the presence of intellectual property laws is waive those rights once they vest. And so, but there's a mid-ground, which is the idea of open source, Creative Commons. There These are types of licenses, primarily copyright, but not exclusively, which are free of charge and have few restrictions on use. There are different versions of Creative Commons licensing, for example. If you look up Creative Commons, you will see that the creator has the ability to choose from different licenses with standard terms, commercial or non-commercial use, with attribution, without attribution, the ability to remix, the no permission to remix. Open source refers to how software can be released with its human-readable source code available upon request. But most of the open source licenses bring with them the obligation to, that anything that software is put into has to then be released open source. But there are a lot of misconceptions. When I posted to Facebook, because I wanted to talk about the fun thing we talked about, one of my friends, who is quite specifically not a lawyer, said, well, she released it into the public, so nobody owns it. Talking about the selfie. And I just didn't even have the heart to differentiate between publicly available and public domain. It wasn't even going to be worth it. I may get to it because I don't want to leave that misunderstanding out there. But this is what you'll be dealing with clients, hopefully not with fellow lawyers. So a lot of real-world interesting issues, and people were talking about who owned the selfie. Cutting edge. All right, any other semi-off-topic questions? All right, let's get back into the body of our discussion. Okay, I thought we'd start with some examples of some money involved in biotechnology and tech transfer. This is from Bloomberg News yesterday. J. Craig Venter, who was the first person to, not on his own, but lead the team that first decoded the human genome, or sequenced it, has a new goal, it says. Help everyone live to 100 in good health. Our goal is to make 100 years old the new 60, said Peter Diamandis, who co-founded with Venter a company that aims to scan the DNA of as many as 100,000 people a year to create a massive database that will lead to new tests and therapies that can help extend healthy human lifespan. Human Longevity Inc., clearly that's not going to be their trademark because I think it's probably merely descriptive, will use machines from Illumina Inc., which has a stake in the company, to decode the DNA of people from children to centenarians. San Diego-based Human Longevity will compile the information into a database that will include information on both the genome and the microbiome, the microbes that live in our gut. The aim is to help researchers understand and address diseases associated with age-related decline. Okay. Anyone see a licensing question here? There are a couple, actually. Well, right, perhaps assuming that the machine's use is covered by some sort of, maybe the software running the aluminum machines, okay. But what about the business itself? What do you think? Were you stretching or did you have a thought? That's the first question, isn't it? Who owns your DNA? We saw last week, or last class, the story of Henrietta Lacks. From a privacy perspective, if you look at medical privacy law, yeah, you do. From a commercialization perspective, it's not entirely clear. There are cases, some really interesting cases about donation of organs and whether the medical release was also a release of any commercial value. They say, I think, that Ozzy Osbourne has a particular genetic, I don't know, what's the opposite of a defect? Benefit that helps him live well, notwithstanding the fact that he lives like Ozzy Osbourne, right? That there are people who represent
the next phase in human evolution.
Right? Who owns? So one really obvious question is, whose DNA is Human Longevity Inc. using? And what, if anything, will be the compensation for those people? Because the flip side is, once this database is developed and populated, the revenue stream seems pretty clear. Licensing access to it. Otherwise, where's the money? Somebody, I mean, the investors, Peter Diamandis funded the XPRIZE that, actually there are a couple of XPRIZEs out there, the XPRIZE that Rutan's company with Spaceship One, first company to send a reusable craft into orbit and back again twice in the space of whatever it was. Now they're going to be, don't do that, sending people up. There are a lot of these X prizes for various, I think the autonomous vehicles were also an X prize. So Diamandis is one of these people who puts money towards futuristic, future-looking endeavors, and obviously Inventor is the scientist involved. But and we know that Illumina Inc. has $70 million in initial funding. Clearly, those people are looking to get something back. Maybe not Diamandis necessarily, because he tends to give money into cool things, but I would imagine that the venture capitalists or angel investors or whomever who's put money into this want something back. The aim is to help researchers understand and address diseases associated with age-related decline. But it's not a university. Even if they're doing good, they will, I expect, try to do well by doing good. But they're basing this revenue stream, at least from what we can tell here, on the analysis of the DNA of 100,000 people a year. And what we don't know, but what we probably would want to know is from where do those people come and what, if any, rights do they have to the benefits of their DNA. We know from watching CSI that we leave, and I'm not trying to be icky here, we leave samples of our DNA everywhere, hair samples, skin cells, you know, lipstick on a collar, whatever. So, on the one level, you don't necessarily have privacy in your identity based on your DNA to the extent that it's like leaving your ID card out. On the other hand, what your DNA says, the information contained within it, I think it's not clear yet. It's enough of a problem figuring out whether patents can cover genetically created organisms. But what protects the ones that pick your personal view of how we got here created? And who gets to capitalize, literally, on that? I guess. On the other hand,
That's well settled case law.
Right. Okay.
Right.
But does that mean that you don't have the rights to commercial value from it?
Oh no, it's personal property. So if I sell an organ, or I want to give you a sample of my blood, you can sell that. That's personal property. What they do if they take your
Right.
So you can commercialize over your own body.
Well, I don't think we have laws against selling one's organs because they don't want poor people to be lining up to sell organs.
Mm-hmm.
Except, you know, you wake up in the hospital room in the ice bath with the mm-hmm. funny scar on one side. So, yeah, I'm not suggesting that Venter's company is going to have patent rights on the DNA. But
it would be the database that's of value there.
It is the database of value, but the database is database protection is also one of those squirrely concepts. If they're just simply factually recording genes, then it's probably not protectable. No, it doesn't. 23andMe charges you to look at your own DNA. They're not then, are they then selling the results to somebody else?
That's what I'm trying to look at their terms of service to see what they do with your genetic information.
It's an interesting question.
So, I mean, they have their legal documents on the website, but I couldn't find anything quickly as far as
from what I've heard about them, at least a primary business model is not meant to be that. Whether a secondary one is?
It's certainly a research thing. That was the underlying drive behind creating a giant genetic database to which they can start to see similarities between the different genetic.
Right. Well, there may be. I think these are likely to be litigated, and then, you know, or they won't, because Venter, part of that $70 million is going to go to very very well-paid lawyers who write up very well-crafted releases where, in consideration for I don't know what, people give up all commercial rights to the result of their DNA analysis. Don't know. Or we'll all be turned into X-Men. But she wasn't required to sign it. She could have said, no, I'd rather pay you for the test, one would imagine. Right. It's very clear. I mean, again, the cases about this sort of thing go back decades. But we're really, I think the difference between the cases and the Henrietta Lacks situation that we looked at the end of last class, and this is sort of literally macro-micro. The cells are, whether it's organs or cultures of cells or even stem cells, they are tangible. They may be small, but they're tangible. There were freezers filled with the HeLa cells and their cloned, reproduced progeny. This is information. This really is intellectual property. Whether it fits with neatly or even clumsily within one of our existing intellectual property boxes, it's pretty clear it doesn't fit within patent. You are not permitted to patent naturally occurring organisms. There are some interesting cases on the margins. So I think what is permitted to get a patent on completely newly created organisms, right? And one may not patent naturally occurring organisms. But there was a rather heated debate and litigation over the Burka? Burka.
Myriad versus what extent is...
So, well, let's step back. There are genetic markers for breast cancer that women, and for that matter, I mean, Tom Maligno had breast cancer. Men do get breast cancer. My father had it. But this is primarily a test for women. And this particular genetic mutation, whatever, right, is a very, very strong signifier of likely breast cancer. And women who test positive, they're counseling for whether they want to do preemptive mastectomies and so on. But as I understand the case, a company sought to patent a detection methodology which involved, but a significant portion of the patent was that snippet of the DNA containing that particular gene. But it wasn't that they were creating it. It was the naturally occurring part. But their argument was that they had incorporated it into a patentable mechanism. It wasn't in its natural form. I don't know where the case ultimately ended, because I know it went back and forth in terms of it was patentable or it wasn't.
Right. So that's it. They drew a line. Basically, so every invention under 101 has to have...
You're going to need to... 101 being the definitions,
right?
Right.
So we went into... So it has to... Naturally occurring is anything that doesn't involve the hand of man, basically. So what they did was they isolate your DNA, which is just draw blood. That's common knowledge that's been around for 30 years now. They look at the DNA and they look for exactly what the professor said is these mutations.
Oh, so it's really not that long ago. This settled last month.
Yeah. So they look at that. And they say, okay, if you have this mutation, you're at risk of breast cancer. If you don't, you don't. And that was what they patented, that method of diagnosing. And what the court said here is that simply isolating DNA and looking at its properties is a naturally occurring phenomenon. It's not patented.
Is that what the latest court decision said? Because like I say, this is...
Yeah. So there's going to be, obviously, now the problem is that the patent office says anytime you write a claim in a patent that says isolating DNA, no matter what comes after that, the patent office says, myriad, isolating DNA is not patentable. So there are exceptions that this case wrote in one of the, around where the holding is, doesn't include if you isolate the DNA, then modify it. So if you tag it with something, if you know, something like that to show, you know, where this mutation is, those things are patentable because that involves an inventive step outside of just isolating, looking at it, and acting based on what you see.
Right.
So
there you go. So this was right. This was this past June Supreme Court case. The genes, the patents on the genes that had been issued were invalidated. There's still patents on methodologies, and that was what settled that other case. So this is very, very much top of mind right now. As we have more information, as we get to read these things, we have to wrestle with to what extent the law already protects people, their privacy, but also their ownership rights. And God only knows what it's going to do to parenting.
So
I don't mean parenting in the parenting sense, but in terms of, you know, you can envision children of parents who were totally created in a lab. I know I read a lot of science fiction, but you were saying, I'm sorry. I was off on
I'm just saying that a court decision like that affects everything from patenting to licensing, because especially in a technology transfer office slide, you have to then decide, okay, there's most of that level, gene identification, that stuff occurs at a university lab. like the Myriad patents, those were developed at UPenn. So those things happen at a university lab. Now, in the past, 5 years ago when I was there, we would patent anytime somebody discovered a new gene, okay? Because we didn't know what the implications were. Maybe the thing turns out to be...
Or rather, you would apply to patent
right.
a new gene.
Well, some of them got issued prior to
right.
2013, but you would file on that sort of stuff. Now, based on this, no, you're not going to file on that. Clearly, it's a waste of money until they isolate the gene, identify what it does in the body, and then determine how it can be used commercially. There's really
right.
three more steps, which is legitimately 3 to 6 more years of research.
And that assumes it works.
Yeah, if the end is good, yeah.
So, a lot of money, still a lot of question. Speaking of a lot of money, today, BioTime Inc. announced it had sold 70,000 shares of a newly authorized Series A convertible preferred stock. How nice. $3.5 million. It plans on investing the proceeds in LifeMap Sciences Inc. to finance product development. So why am I telling you about this nice transaction? Because we scroll down to find out what these businesses are. BioTime Inc. is a biotech company engaged in research and product development in the field of regenerative medicine. Regenerative medicine refers to therapies based on stem cell technology that are designed to rebuild cell and tissue function lost due to degenerative disease or injury. And then you see all their different products, and then we see the last sentence. They had developed Hextend R, I guess that's a trademark, is manufactured and distributed in the U.S. by Hospira Inc. and in South Korea by CJ Cheljinan Corporation under exclusive licensing agreements. Creating technology, licensing it to manufacturers, two different countries, which means they at least have patent protection in those two different countries. And based on that model, $3.5 million in new shares. These are real issues. So, yep.
I just found the waiver of property rights in 23andMe.
Okay. So there you go. It's basically razor and razor blades, right? Although it's not quite razor and razor blades. It's this come on, like your future sister-in-law. We'll do this nice test for you for out of the goodness of our pocketbooks or for commercial, you know, for consumer pricing, at least until the FDA steps in and says, well... You know, what are you exactly saying? What are you telling people? It's not really approved to diagnose or treat diseases. What are you telling people? And then they have some problems. But it's interesting.
FDA will get you back with all the Belmont report stuff that you need to comply with before you take that and make this thing legal. Anyway, different class.
So we talked, you know, some of these issues that underlie this ownership, as we've seen, very complicated. It's complicated not only the individual versus the institution, but it's complicated the professor or the graduate student, university, research foundation, government, grant writer, grant providing company, who
you
owns what?
Stanford versus Roche in here, in the class? That confuses basically the government conflicting with the government.
Well, yes, of course, I think that's in the book. I think that was in the book. In any event, but you know, thinking on the transactional side. So we have all these different issues, but timing, because things do take so long to come to market, how quickly things change and so on. But there is law. I know it may come as a surprise given how far-ranging our discussion has been, but there is specific law. And this is the Bayh-Dole Act, named for the two senators who put their names to the original act. You've got, it starts at 35 U.S.C. 200, regulations 37 CFR Part 401. So, as I think I mentioned last class, because the dollars are, figures are, the costs are so high, and not everybody is a Craig Venter or Peter Diamandis. Universities certainly don't have, well, most, certainly ours, don't have tens of millions of dollars lying around to just hand off to researchers. Nor do they necessarily have the ability to turn what is discovered into life-saving, world-changing products. And there is a strong governmental interest in supporting research and development of all kinds. Because A, more development leads to more products, leads to more economic growth, leads to more competitiveness in the world. Why, you know, were patent and copyright so important to the founders? It wasn't just because they liked artists and inventors. It was because they were trying to establish an economy, a standalone competitive economy, both internally and externally. And they wanted to create a legal system to support that. Well, what we have today, in order to compete, you need to do seriously expensive research and development in all sorts of places. And so the government has an interest that way, but it also has an interest as a user. If you think about medical treatments, particularly things like neurological treatments, treatments for amputations, prosthetics, there, it is somewhat of a bittersweet fact that the fatality rate for troops in combat in similar situations is much lower than it used to be. The military personnel who would die in combat from an explosion of a particular size in 1940 or 1950 or 1970, today very well may not, because we have gotten that much better at treating traumatic brain injuries and limb injuries and so on. That's the good part. The bad part is then we have to support all of those veterans who have permanent brain damage or are missing limbs and the like. The good news is they survive to come home. But the challenge is that they have to live lives, and we want them to live lives. And so for medical, if you think about the size of the military, hundreds of thousands of active duty troops, all of whom are getting medical care. So the government, just that one piece of the government, the federal government, has a vested interest in supporting medical research for its military employees and for public health. It saves money when we don't have epidemics. And so that's both prevention and treatment of disease is a of national importance. And so the government funds a lot of this stuff, but then you have a question. Because how much should government funding mean that the researchers and the developers aren't entitled to profit? Is it like copyright for government works, where if the government does it, it's public domain? There are arguments to be made for that, but can anyone see a really good argument why that wouldn't be the right approach? The government funds it, you don't get to own it. What happens next?
Incentivized to commercially develop.
Right. You don't end up with companies. You might end up with researchers in labs who like being researchers in labs, but most people are not going to put together a marketing plan, feed a sales force, advertise, manufacture for the public good. And most shareholders would not put up with it. So there needed to be, as the need for public funding of research and development expanded, as the scope of these projects, outside of pure military or science or aerospace, right, but these were civilian projects with public good elements in the tens of millions of dollars. So as those became more and more a part of research, Congress needed to strike this balance. Needed to figure out, what do we do about government-funded research? What rights do we permit? What rights do we keep? And so in the Bayh-Dole Act and its regulations, what we have is the pathway. We have the balance between the public good and the private benefit. So the first really important and not immediately obvious point, they didn't have to go this way. And if you look at the cases, that's why I do actually ask you to read the cases, you can see where the controversies lie, where the pressures are. Those are all, I think, post-Bayh-Dole, or most of them are. But the question was, if the federal government pays for it, are we going to permit the researchers rather than the federal government to patent it? And Bayh-Dole Act says yes. The default rule here is yes. That even if government money is paying for this research, the researchers, if they're private or university researchers, not working in, say, the National Institutes of Health, but private or outside entities receiving federal funding are nonetheless permitted to apply for and, if eligible, receive and then utilize patents. So yes, we preserve the right to make money even if the government is paying. But in return, so what does the government get out of it? Well, one thing the government gets out of it is a license, akin to the shop right we talked about as a general matter that employers get if their employees come up with an invention in the workplace. Even without an assignment, the employers, remember, have the right to use that invention within the enterprise, not to sell it, but to use it. Similarly, part of this deal, this statutory deal, is the government pays, the government gets a non-transferable license to make the invention. So if it's a pharmaceutical, the government doesn't then have to turn to the manufacturer it funded and ask it nicely, right, to please grant a license to the government to manufacture. No, the government has a license, and they can then contract with a manufacturer without worrying about paying royalties.
That term right there has to be incorporated in any license.
Why don't you explain that?
So, procedurally, you get...
Who's the you in this?
There's no you. I'm going to retract you. Procedurally, the government gives an individual a research grant. Anything, we'll call it Professor Ezor. They give him a research grant.
Oh, please.
For $1 million.
Oh, please.
Something. Software program. He then develops that. He accepts that grant award and then develops software under the auspices of Professor Ezor at Goro Law Center. Under Baidol, as a term of accepting that grant, he is then to disclose that software program to the university, to Toro. Toro then has obligations because they took that grant money, and Professor Ezor took that grant money to go and report that to the government. All right, that's all the government wants right now is report it, and the government takes a look at it, which they actually don't do, and they release the rights. Right, Baidol creates a what I'll akin to is a first right of refusal in anything doctor, anything they funded, anything Professor Ezor funded. They always release it. Okay, that's released. It's back to the university. He goes and funds it. Now the university has 1 year, I believe it's 1 year or maybe 6 months, 1 year to patent that technology or release it back to the government and or Professor Ezor. Once that's done, usually they patent it. Once they patent it, they're free to license it, which is what we've been talking about all semester. If you license it, the government gets a non-exclusive, fully paid-up, royalty-free license to use that technology at any point in time in the future. And that must go in any one patent application and two any license agreement. It's a provision right in there, all rights granted here under subsequent to federal government's
I think you've been to subject.
Right. Yeah.
So right so subject. Thank you. I appreciate that taking us through it, and God willing we should get such a grant. But anyway, so just as in a very different context in commercial lending, if a company wants to borrow money and there's a certain amount, a certain thing that they want to use as collateral, and there is a senior claim, a pre-existing claim on that collateral, the second lender must be told about the first lender and that the first lender has priority. That's just part of it. It's why when you finance your car purchase, there's a notation on your car's title that gets filed that the lender has a claim. So that since you have to hand over your title to sell your car, no one can buy the car without knowing about the claim. Well, that's not, when I say it's somewhat similar in that let's say that I've created this wonderful patentable invention, and the college has decided that I'm permitted to go out and try to commercialize it myself. Great. So I go out and someone says to me, we love the invention, we want to license it from you, and we want an exclusive license. I am legally obligated under the terms that I through which I originally got my funding from the government to say, that's great, that's wonderful, and I'm happy to give you an exclusive asterisk license because it's exclusive except that there is another license out there for the federal government that it has. So whatever you want to do with this, I wouldn't don't expect to do a lot of government sales of this software, because they already have a license. I can't do anything about that. You can be exclusive within your category, whatever, but I'm required to disclose and incorporate into the license agreements the fact of this pre-existing, fully paid, royalty-free, non-transferable license. So the government's not allowed to then compete with me in trying to find licensees, but it is permitted to do it. But there's also this really interesting thing about march-in rights, which sounds very martial, doesn't it? Because why is the government funding this? The government is funding research which is not just for pure theory. The government is funding research that is supposed to lead to things that are good for the country, i.e. brought to market in some way. And if they aren't brought to market, the government has the rights to come in and bring them to market in order to make sure that the public is served by this public money that was used. So we hear about non-practicing patent holders, patent trolls. Sometimes they are the original inventors. They have the patent, but for whatever reason, they don't want to make it themselves. They don't want to find a licensee. They just want to litigate. Well, that's not going to fly here. Because if the government paid for it, the government wants somebody building it and selling it or making it and selling it. And so the government reserves the rights to come in and make that happen. Is that a good way of describing march-in rights?
Yeah.
So let's take a look at Bayh-Dole specifically. This is the why of Bayh-Dole. This is right up front. It is the policy and objective of the Congress to use the patent system to promote the utilization of inventions arising from federally supported research or development, to encourage maximum participation of small business firms in federally supported research and development efforts. Why does small business get a particular lift from this sort of process? Think about it. What doesn't small business have that large business might? Money. Right? So small business, if it weren't permitted to then go ahead and find licensees, it wouldn't bother with federal funding. They can't afford to do all the manufacture themselves. To promote collaboration between commercial concerns and nonprofit organizations, including universities, to ensure that inventions made by nonprofit organizations and small business firms are used in a manner to promote free competition and enterprise without unduly encumbering future research and discovery, to promote the commercialization and public availability of inventions made in the United States by United States industry and labor. Right there. Right there. Economic development. U.S. industry, U.S. labor, U.S. inventions in a competitive, as opposed to what? The rest of the world. Global marketplace, help companies here, inventors here, compete. Why is it that the export division of the Commerce Department is co-sponsoring a conference here on Friday morning? Because it has a mission of helping businesses compete in a global environment, including education efforts, like the conference on Friday. And I'm almost certain that Bayh-Dole will get mentioned when they talk about IP.
That, just briefly, that right there is another clause that has to go in any university or whatever license is.
The one I just read, or the next one?
No, licensor will make best efforts to
Right. This is not an encouragement to outsource.
Yeah.
To ensure, no, it's not required. It's interesting. You hear what the practical language is, use best efforts,
mm-hmm.
because there may not be the capabilities or the willingness, but you got to try.
Well, you want the university or whoever the company is who's receiving. receiving this funding, the last thing you want to do is violate the bank, right? So you
right.
just want, you don't want to have them cut off your funds or...
Right, because they don't have to give you the next grant.
Yeah, they could pull this grant, you know, in the middle of it if you go against them. So you want to comply
right.
with all of their terms.
So even if you're not expressly breaching it, because you are using your best efforts, you really want to use more efforts because they're not going to look upon you favorably. To ensure that the government obtains sufficient rights in federally supported inventions to meet the needs of the government and protect the public against non-use or unreasonable use of inventions, and to minimize the costs of administering policies in this area. There you go. And because of this, it's a little wordy. That is a single sentence. It's really wordy. But that's Congress for you. That's it. Right here. Here's your balance. Encourage economic development. Support small business competition. Encourage U.S. economic development. Positive trade balance, and also protect the government, make sure it doesn't have to pay more for what it needs, and that what it pays for isn't used in a negative way. Yeah?
What was the work in the National Laboratory? We did an astronomical amount of SBIRs or small business innovative research type grants where the laboratory will identify needs it has in certain projects it's working on. Where I was on synchrotron. Businesses and they all bid on small grants, $500,000, $1 million in phases, and they come back. We're talking about the accelerators of small.
Never mind. You're right.
And then we would use them in machines and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, so let's take a look specifically at the march-in rights. This notion of what if there isn't sufficient effort to commercialize. Here we go. Okay, I did this in Word so I can make it nice and big. He says, okay, you guys can see this now, I hope. So this is right in the middle of Bayh-Dole. With respect to any subject invention in which a small business firm or nonprofit organization has acquired title under this chapter, meaning has a patent, is permitted to have a patent, the federal agency under whose funding agreement the subject of invention was made shall have the right, in accordance with such procedures as are provided in regulations promulgated hereunder, to require the contractor, an assignee or exclusive licensee of subject invention, to grant a non-exclusive, partially exclusive, or exclusive license in the field to a responsible applicant or applicants upon terms that are reasonable under the circumstances. To require the contractor, an assignee or an exclusive licensee, the party that has the legal ability to license the invention, to grant a non-exclusive, partially exclusive or exclusive license in any field of use of a responsible applicant or applicants under terms that are reasonable under the circumstances. require the contractor to grant a license, a legitimate, reasonable license. And if the contractor assigned their exclusive licensee refuses such request to grant, the agency shall have the right to grant such a license itself, not just use it, but license it out if the agency determines that such action is necessary because the contractor assignee has not taken or is not expected to take within a reasonable time effective steps to achieve practical application of the subject invention in such field of use. Bring it to market. Use it. This is not about theory. This is not to support pure research. This is to bring things to the public marketplace for the public benefit. And if necessary, the agency will do it itself. If it determines that such action is necessary to alleviate health or safety needs, which are not reasonably satisfied by the contractor, assignee, or their licensees. I think a few years ago there was an issue with flu vaccines, and they were not being produced by the patent holder quickly enough. I do believe that the federal government stepped in to enable other firms to manufacture, and it was not taken very well, because it wasn't that they weren't manufacturing, but they weren't necessarily manufacturing fast enough. If it determines that such action is necessary to meet requirements for public use specified by federal regulations, and such requirements are not reasonably satisfied by the contractor, assignee, or licensees, or the action is necessary because the agreement required by Section 204 has not been retained or waived, or because a licensee of the exclusive right is in breach of its agreement obtained pursuant to Section 204. So basically,
that's what we were just talking about. So there's two ways, there's two people that are responsible to this, right? One, the person, the party who the government gives the right to grant licenses to.
Right, so the licensor. So a remedy for breach. When you draft contracts generally, and we'll get into very shortly, right, I think that's our next discussion, is starting to look at drafting. But as a general matter, with any contract, you provide remedies for breach. Well, what this is saying and what we're hearing is that if it's a license agreement granted under a Bayh-Dole funding, one of the remedies for breach that the agreement is supposed to explicitly provide, and the statute essentially provides, is that the licensee will lose any exclusivity, lose the ability, right? Because the exclusivity is in the commercial sphere. Yes, the government can produce for itself, but the licensee will then lose whatever exclusivity it has. Because of its breach, it's not just that it loses the license, that even if the license might still be there and in force, if it doesn't perform, it's going to find itself being competed with by another company hired by the government in its place. And that's what this says. So, yeah, the patent holder has an obligation to accept, to seek out and accept responsible applications for licenses, or the government will step in. The government may also license itself if it needs it for public safety or to meet requirements for public use. let's say that the patent involved ensuring that radio-enabled devices are not putting out dangerous amounts of radiation. It's shielding for cellular radios, just off the top of my head, right? So that's a, and the FCC requires that all devices with these kind of radios will have shielding. And if the shielding patent holder won't make that shielding available, the federal government can go ahead and exercise its rights here to hire someone else to produce the shielding so that public use, as required by federal regulations, is enabled. And if the licensee exists but isn't stepping up and fulfilling its obligations, you see, that's specifically an exclusive right. If there's an exclusive licensee and it's not doing its job, it will no longer be an exclusive licensee. And then there's a process. So it's not simply the government says, we do this, due process requirements. The determination is not subject to certain things, but there is an appeals process that is to be put in place. And there is a right of appeal to the U.S. Court of Federal Claims, which shall have jurisdiction to determine the appeal on the record and to affirm, reverse, remand, or modify as appropriate the determination of the federal agency. So there's recourse in case the affected parties feel that this determination was incorrect. Yeah, it did say it was expedited. Well, they said on the record, which I guess means they don't have to necessarily do a full trial and everything else. You apply to the Court of Federal Claims.
So you
it has.
Really get
you do. You get expedited due process. Would you rather be required to wait for a federal, even in the Rocket Docket set, right? This is the equivalent of an administrative appeal, but it's got the weight of a federal court behind. Well, it doesn't necessarily say. It just says to determine the appeal on the record.
Well, I was just thinking of using your flu example. That seemed like that would probably be a fairly quick turnaround.
I would think that, courts have, right, courts have procedures for expediting things, right? You don't have to wait for the Supreme Court to hear your death penalty appeal for it to make its way through the certiorari process, for example. So I'm sure that the Court of Federal Claims procedure has something for expediting that determination. So, lots of these challenges, embryonic stem cells, which have had some significant funding issues, federal, state funding, there's a lot of religious and other issues, genome sequencing, as we see, created organisms we've discussed, cells from a specific human, such as Henrietta Lacks, issues of medical hazards in the research side, as well as liability issues. And then, one of the reasons you have a Court of Federal Claims is when you get into these significant, very detailed patent disputes, especially in biotech, it's a substantial challenge for lawyers, who don't do this stuff, and the courts to really understand it well. Any questions? Have a good night.